The book itself is by Dean M. Kelly, Why Conservative Churches Are Growing, and he says in the revised edition that a better title would be Why Strict Churches Are Growing, but he lost the battle with his editor. If you're ever in a battle with your editor, there's never any question who's going to win. And this seemed to be a more appealing word, conservative rather than strict. And because there are many conservative churches, and not all of them are growing, but some of the strict churches, especially from the moral, in the standpoint of ethics and morality and dedication, or what we call discipleship, are the ones which are growing. And he discovered this and wrote the first edition of this, which came out in 1971. And it's not that he's propagandizing for his own cause, because he is a high-ranking bureaucrat in the National Council of Churches. And if you know the NCC, it's not really, you know, a hotbed of conservatism by any stretch of the imagination. Not good old 475 Riverside Drive. It's right across from Union Seminary, and they're all right together. They're Riverside Church and sort of the Protestant, you know, Vatican of right on of New York, where we were. It's very exciting. Anyway, then a lot of people challenged his statistics, and he kept doing more research, and came out now this last year in 1977, right? And what the recent research and the new statistics show that he was righter now than he was before. I mean, he had reasonably good conclusions before, but now he's got almost an airtight case. So Harper, the publisher, reissued the book with some updated statistics. And maybe some of you know the Kelly thesis. We call it the Kelly thesis, and I want to just go through a little bit of discussion. I mean, a little bit of, you know, material, and then we can have the discussion, because I'd much rather have that. And I've got to perform at 6:45 tonight anyway, so on Jimmy Carter. So the surprising thing that he found, and this is the basic thesis, is that the more strict in terms of discipleship and obedience and loyalty to doctrine the churches are, in an age which is, you know, visibly more secular, more materialistic, more hedonistic and all of that, the more strict you are, the faster your membership grows, which doesn't, you know, on the surface seem plausible. Why should it be, if we are becoming more materialistic, more secular minded, more world, whatever, you know, adjectives you want to use, should the really old-fashioned square churches, I mean, these he's talking about Mormons, Assemblies of God, which is Pentecostal, of course, and there has an extra tie in there, Jehovah's Witness, the other one, Seventh-day Adventists, they're growing enormously. Mormons, for instance, in the last 6 years, the Mormon church has grown over 2.5 million members, while the general, you know, population is going down. And that's, you know, church, you know, bishops sit up and take notice when they get those kind of statistics coming in. While on the other hand, what we call the mainline churches, and we call them mainline only, if you heard Yoder last week, he talked about this too, we call them mainline only because they're the largest. It has nothing to do with being right or wrong or good or bad theology. Presbyterian, Episcopalian, UCC, or Congregational, and Methodist, are mainline, and their total, they're all, you see, Anglo-Saxon origins, and, the, you know, were here first. Now, Lutherans didn't get here first. They might be right, but the rightest, but they weren't the firstest anyway. Mainline churches, those four bodies have lost 2.7 million members since 1967, which also makes church bishops sit up and take notice when something like that happens. Now, you can argue, and there's some validity to the argument, that some of that dropout was due simply to Deadwood finally making the final plunge. And I know at least we have at least two pastors here. You know how much Deadwood, you know, is oftentimes carried. I mean, 6 months later, the pledge box hasn't been picked up, right? And which is true back where we are. And you soon get the idea that, you know, they're not going to pick up their pledge box. Yeah, they're sort of, you know, they're a little casual. You don't want to be, you know. And, they don't use the old system that they used once, where you get teams and you take the pledge boxes around on Pledge Sunday and so on. Those things. Anyway, maybe we should. But that's generally the thesis that Kelly is proposing. And if for those who haven't been here before, my particular field is current American, that I do my research in, is current American religious history. And I'm looking, and what I've been doing here at Holden is looking at the various changes, the dramatic changes that are taking place in our religious life, not from a strict theological position, I leave that to others, but from the standpoint of other kinds of forces at work, which tell us really something about what's happening in American religious life. And mine is more a journalistic, if you like, kind of report rather than a theological kind of thing. But that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm leaving the heavy stuff, you know, to the others. Okay. So one of the major trends then is the strict pattern. All right. And then the question, of course, becomes, you know, why should this be the case? All right. Let me try something here and see what kind of a result I get. This is Kelly in his introduction, and he has four criteria for a church, okay? I won't tell you what I'm going to do with this, all right? First, it is generally assumed that religious enterprises, if they want to succeed, will be reasonable, rational, courteous, responsible, restrained, and receptive to outside criticism. That is, they will want to preserve a good image in the world, as the world defines all these terms. Two, it is expected, moreover, that they will be democratic and gentle in their internal affairs, again, as the outside world defines these qualities. Three, they will also be responsive to the needs of peoples, as currently conceived, and will want to work cooperatively with other groups to meet those needs. Sounds good. Four, they will not let dogmatism, judgmental moralism, or obsessions with cultic purity stand in the way of such cooperation and service. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Everybody agree, those four criteria sound pretty good for a church? You already see the trap, don't you? Right. Have you read the book?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's why. All right. But those four criteria sounds good. Reasonable, rational, courteous, receptive to outside criticism, gentle in internal affairs, responsive to the needs of people, work cooperatively with others, won't let dogmatism and so on stand in the way. Sounds terrific. Where can I buy one of those? And page 16 in his introduction, Kelly concludes, these expectations are a recipe for the failure of the religious enterprise and arise from a mistaken view of what success in religion is and how it should be fostered and measured. So he really sets you up, you know, with these four criteria as to what, you know, all of us, I think, would agree are kind of criteria we would like in our church. Not talking about, you know, the rightness and wrongness of a doctrine, but just the general way, style in which we approach the world. And what Kelly has proved through his statistics, that these are a recipe for failure, which makes you sit back and wonder, you know, something about what's going on here. And as I suggested, he's got, you know, very good statistics, very, very good statistics for this. Okay. And further, what's happening, elaborate on that point. What seems to be happening is a breakdown in what we were all so enthused about and excited about just even a few years ago, and that's what we call the ecumenical movement. The least ecumenical bodies are the ones that are, you know, doing the best. And therefore, what does that say about the kind of church, church life and religious enterprise in which we're living today? You know, for some of you, you know, we can ask the question, whatever happened to COCU or COCU, Consultation on Church Union? This was going to be the big merger. 10 bodies were going to be in this, and right now it's reduced primarily to one devoted secretary and a good ditto machine and a mailing list is about what's happened. But I remember when Bishop Pike and, you know, Eugene Carson Blake and everybody got we are one, you remember John 17 and the whole thing, and good text, you know, for ecumenism, and all of a sudden it's really sort of gone down. All right. Now, the question, of course, after something like that becomes, and this is what we want to talk about today, why? Why this should be happening? Why, let me read you, for instance, I guess we can let that go for a little while. Why this should be happening? The churches that are the strictest on doctrine, the strictest on things, even like with the Mormons, they don't even drink tea, if I'm not mistaken. I know there's no coffee or alcohol or tobacco, and I think tea is even considered a stimulant. Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, I mentioned Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists, and so on, very strict, and of course, we know from medical statistics that these people also have fewer heart attacks and lower blood pressure and you know, all the rest of these things. So, you know, when they get large numbers of people, they get very interested in that kind of thing. Now, just for fun, what do you think the reasons are? While the mainline, the reasonable churches are going down. Kelly doesn't necessarily have a lot of answers. He's just trying to sort of challenge people with this kind of, you know, development. While mainline are going down and the world seems to be getting more secular, because most of us, I think, have grown up out of our kind of fundamentalistic Lutheranism in which we were reared, at least I can speak for myself. Coming out of a Hauge tradition, I had some distance to go, you know. And so, and we're kind of proud of the fact, really, not proud, but satisfied at least with the fact that we have gotten through this sort of thing. What do you think?
Well, I think one of the things that you just have already said is it a reaction to what we might say is a secularism? Just as an example, we live in Marin County, which
oh boy.
Now has become fairly well known.
Go ahead.
It's fairly well known as being the hedonism capital of
I read the serial.
States.
Yeah, I read the serial, yeah.
And then NBC came in and did a documentary, and primarily based on the serial.
Yeah.
And I was just reading the paper before we left, and there's been all kinds of responses to that and denials of that. And some Texas evangelist, 26 years old, was down in Texas, and he all of a sudden got a call from the Lord to go and save Mill Valley. Which was the community that the NBC documentary focused on. And immediately, this young fella comes in, and immediately he has a following. Immediately, people just flock to this guy, which I think is, that's sort of riding on the emotions of I see something that I don't like, I'm going to try this.
Can I tell, some of you know I like to tell stories, my Johnny Carson story about he was driving along the Santa Monica freeway and his car broke down. He drove over to the side and found it was a carburetor. He took it out, spread it on a blanket so he could repair it, and 30 minutes later he had 12 people kneeling in adoration and worship. An instant new sect in Southern California, you know. This fellow really did get a following in Mill Valley?
In a way, yeah.
By the mellowed, laid-back...
I would say by others.
Others, right.
Maybe some.
Some of you, it's what you call about a, rated an R novel, I think. It, don't expect it, you know, for moral uplift, but it's a very funny novel, The Serial, about Marin County. Is it accurate?
Well, I guess I would say that it is accurate, and that's what makes it so tragic,
yeah.
To hear a community denying that which is really the truth.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of the new center, like America supposedly for a while, you know, Orange County, California, where you had Disneyland and the Birch Society and all the rest of these things, and Anaheim and all these places, and now all this is all changing. I think that's part of it. What is the appeal of strictness, though?
In times of change, people are looking for something that's hard, something that's sure, certain. And a strict theology and a strict code, you know, follows that. You don't have any more questions. It's all laid out for you. You don't have to worry about the change anymore. You can hide from it.
Well, what he's saying, that idea, I think, is an extension of the same. But when you were talking there, I was thinking that I wonder if the same kind of psychology that works on people liking Star Wars so much, which everyone, I mean, it's so obvious that it's black and white, good and bad, you know, that everyone goes to it, knows that.
I saw it three times.
Yeah. You did, yeah. But you might want to join strict sect now. But
Close Encounters was more religious than Star Wars.
That was more, yeah. But this was so open and so obvious what the thing, nobody, even the littlest child,
yeah.
The smallest child could, and I wonder if that might be some of the same psychology of wanting to go to more strictness, like you said. You know, either black and white, or you know, it's out plain and in the open.
But sometimes people just don't want to have to think.
Too. Yeah, they're, no choice.
That kind of personality that just wants to lay back and have someone tell them exactly how they're supposed to live and how they're supposed to think, and then if anything goes wrong, then they've got someone else to blame. They don't have to blame their own.
And then sometimes people want something that has
the possibility of or is in motion, that it's got a momentum. Isn't it Eric Cocker who talks about
the true believer?
The true believer, and that things will go ahead. You know, a movement will move, and people will just be caught up in it, and it'll really accomplish things while it's moving. It's like building the new sanctuary attached to your old church. I'm telling you, when that thing is going up, it's just, you know, it's marvelous. And when the dedication is over, you can't keep it up. You get new members while the thing's going up, and it's just grand.
Yeah, when we burn the mortgage on our church, that's the worst thing that could have happened. It's just no more challenge.
I think there's a security that for some of these people, that they don't want to do any thinking or feeling for them. And there's a security there. Someone else is doing this thinking for them, and they don't have to take any risks.
But what has to exist before they'll accept that authority? I mean, there are a lot of, you know, gurus and preachers. I get on the mailing list of some pretty funny ones. Once you get on one mailing list, the postman looks at me. You know, I get some pretty strange stuff. Herald of His Coming and Zion's Trumpet and, you know, a lot of strange stuff. He thought I was this, you know, harmless history teacher up there and come through with some thunderbolt and everything. But what, there are a lot of preachers, you know, all looking for, you know, followers in this country. And so in order, what you say is right, but there, you know, let's push it back a step.
They're frightened.
Frightened of what? Well, there are a lot of things you can belong to, Rotary and, you know, right. And...
their conscience tells them that there is something that they do not have. Greater that they themselves do not have, and it's making their life very insecure.
Yes, that there has to be, there has to be, before you make this kind of commitment, it's like taking a vow, for instance, to be a nun or something, you have to know pretty sure, pretty clearly, not very clearly, what to expect. And that's why they have novitiates and so on.
I wonder if you're not strict and you become more social-minded, this type of thing, I wonder if it could be they feel that this, you have joined them. They want something different than they are. They go and join something more strict or something of that nature, looking for something that isn't the same as they are. They're always seeking something different.
Well, there are some people who are just born seekers and move from one to another. Most famous in American religious history, hopefully some of you remember Roger Williams. Way back, he started off as a strict Congregationalist and wound up so far out in left field there wasn't a ballpark any longer. And in our own time, really, and I admire him for it, Michael Novak, if any of you follow him, is very much this. But I think some people see their lives as a pilgrimage. But to come to the idea about having somebody else do your thinking for you, which is certainly a part of our time, and there are many, you know, as I say, gurus, why are they willing to do that? Because in America, you know, the old tradition of rugged individualism, and I'm as good as you are, your opinion's as good as mine. Well, no, we don't believe that, but my opinion is as good as yours, and so on. And, you know, why are they willing to buy into some of the strict stuff? I mean, what has to exist before what you said is the
fear.
Case? Fear of what?
Social change. The center is gone. There isn't really any more agreement on a code.
Yeah, the center is gone.
You know, what used to be back in the 50s, I mean, you know, I could play golf the whole time and things would just move along because there was enough agreement on things. And now things are starting to come apart for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
And people sense that coming apart, and yet they don't want to deal with it in their religion. I think they want that as a place of solace, comfort, a haven. And if you have a code, a church which provides you with social activity, which provides you with a code of ethics, everything complete, I mean, it's a total package. One-stop spiritual shopping.
These go all the way through your life, too. You know, I mean, they're going to, the strict code of your daily life, what you eat, what you wear, the number of hours, your time even, that you want, it's all these strict things. So there's got to be really something great to appeal to for that much of their effort and time and energies into that strict church.
there's a work righteousness in a thing right there in which they are probably working out something for themselves, which has been a blight in their lives before.
If I could tie some things together here, and all of these have been very good, in a very real sense, it's a good for American tradition. This sort of religion works. You can see results in your life. You can see results in the congregation. You can see, you know, the pledges going up, and you can see building going up. And there isn't ambiguity, and it's difficult to live with ambiguity. He's got a marvelous thing here, if I had time. He's got a made-up discussion of what they can do to increase more enthusiasm in the church. And it's just like he's gone to every council meeting, you know, that there ever was in a mainline Protestant church. Well, we've tried this, so let's try that, you know, and everything else. And what everybody else is trying to do is use some old traditional methods of increasing enthusiasm and loyalty, and they're obviously all failures. But I think with the really strict disciplines, that the it's the idea that if the membership fee, so to speak, here, I don't want to put it strictly in those terms, is high enough, or the demands are high enough, you're gonna, you know, the people are gonna want it bad enough. Maybe, you know, mainline churches, including the Lutheran churches, expect too little of their members. Let's talk about that one a little later, because 3 weeks ago when we did this, we had a rouser, and people kept going for 2 hours afterwards on that one, and some people weren't talking afterwards. And who was the pastor from Yankton, South Dakota? He was still mad at me at the when he left. But anyway, I said, I'm just a facilitator. I'm not, you know, I'm not David Preuss. But anyway,
reminds me of a basic economic lesson. A friend said she had was selling a kitten. She put an ad in paper for $10 for a kitten. There was another person selling a kitten for $10. And her father said, increase the price to $15. Any fool that's going to pay $10 for a kitten wants a $15 kitten, not a $10 kitten.
And I think that's
spirituality, too. Yeah.
Because it increases your sense, really, of accomplishment, because you can measure up to a code which brings out things. It's like earning merit badges. I remember how I wanted those merit badges and would do some awfully, you know, foolish things. You know, more scouts is a good thing, don't take me wrong, but, you know, I'd give up other things. But I think that's part of it. But, you know, what about, you know, the times in which we live? What does that tell us about the popularity of the strict sects?
Well, we're discouraged, I think, at this time. We're not the, I don't believe as American people, we're not optimistic in the future about anything. We're rather pessimistic, I think, recently about our future, our country now, our morals.
I'm going to talk, don't give away, that's my talk tonight.
Oh.
Really, yeah. Really, I think there's very much to that. But then why, you know, then why not wine, women, and song as the alternative?
We probably have some of that too.
Yes, we certainly do. You know, what's that? Is that Peggy Lee? If that's all there is, then bring out the booze and let's start the dancing. Isn't that a song that? Yeah. And instead of, you know.
I think the wine, women, and song would be an escape, an alternative escape under a different, not pessimism, but something more dangerous than pessimism.
Cynicism.
Closer to war or losing. And then, but this is probably cynicism, pessimism, a fear too. I think that's, someone said that's one thing. And it drives you to, I suspect it would drive us to seeking some kind of firm foundation of hope and a firm foundation we can guide our lives by somehow. You know, something solid so we can argue for ourselves and what we do. You can only do that if you've got good outlines, you know, to really... I'm drifting away.
No.
I better stop because
okay.
I'm just thinking off
we'll
the top of my
come
head.
Back. Yeah.
Well, I think there's not only the legalistic requirements, but something maybe that you've alluded to already is the biblical, the concentration in terms of the biblical message on the end, it's coming, it's over. You better be in the right place at the right time. And we can tell you right now that this is the place to be. And look at the signs of the time.
Yeah, you picked that up. I'm not surprised that all of these are premillennial churches. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a big word for some of you, and it shouldn't be, but should we have a short course in premillennial eschatology here? That always wakes people up or else scares them when I use terms like that. Eschatology, that's the doctrine of the last things.
Okay, gotcha.
Just made that up, that's real.
death, judgment, resurrection, ascension. And premillennial, there are three schools, very briefly, there are three schools of the end times. The premillennial, postmillennial, and amillennial, and the main line, including the Lutheran position, is amillennial. But the premillennial people take Revelation 21-6, isn't it, as their key? And then, as Clifford Nelson at our school always used to say, the happy hunting ground of the book of Daniel. And you can find more apocalyptic predictions in the book of Daniel. I mean, you can, you know, make that into anything you want it. But in Revelation 21-6, they talk about the millennium in which Christ will come back, and there'll be the Battle of Armageddon. And there are plenty of books on the Battle of Armageddon out now, and they're selling tremendously. And Hal Lindsey, you know, out of money, he's written the same book four times. And all he does one thing well. He has good, snappy titles. I'll have to give him credit for that. But we've got tapes here by Roy Harrisville and Jim Burtness and some of the others, which just show that his exegesis is just plain wrong. I mean, his translation from the Greek is just wrong. And if you start from a wrong premise, you're not going to reach the right conclusion. And I'll be glad to refer you if some of you, you know, want to follow up on Lindsey on that. But the books are selling tremendously, and the premillennial position is that there'll be the Battle of Armageddon, and then Christ will rule the world has to be getting progressively worse before the Battle of Armageddon can take place. And so if you're an Adventist, the worse the world is, the happier you are, because the closer the second coming is. You know, I would hear radio preachers who would say that they would step out of their door in the morning, and the first thing they would do is not, you know, and growing up in the farm, you look, you know, at the windmill to see what direction the wind is from, but you would expect Jesus to be coming in. I mean, literally, bodily coming in. Like that marvelous introduction to La Dolce Vita. You remember the movie where they had a helicopter bringing a statue of Christ over Rome? You know, unbelievable Fellini kind of introduction to a movie, apocalyptic theme. Christ was returning to Rome, and it was totally decadent. And then the rest of the movie went on to show how decadent Rome was. But then there'll be the Battle of Armageddon. Then Christ will reign bodily and physically on earth, on the great white throne, for 1,000 years. And there won't be any changes, so to speak, in life on earth. I mean, even the mosquitoes will stay alive for 1,000 years. I'm not being sarcastic or anything. This is what, you know, the people say will happen. And the beast of the field will lie down and lie, you know, in peace with one another. And then there will be the final judgment, Matthew 25, 26, and so on. And that's premillennial. The world has to get worse before the millennium can come, before Christ will return. The postmillennium is just the opposite, which was popular in 19th century, 18th and 19th century America, in which the world is gradually getting better. And that conditions, there'll be more, you know, fellowship, more righteousness, more peace, joy, love, all of these things. And then when the world conditions are right, then Christ will come and reign bodily. The post-millennium, there'll be 1,000 years, you see, millennium, obviously 1,000, 1,000 years of reign of peace and goodwill, then Christ will come to judge the quick and the dead. And then, but these are literal time things that will actually take place in history. And the mainline position, the Lutheran position, and the Lutheran position is the amillennium. There will be no literal millennium that takes place. Now, just for fun, let me ask you, why are the premillennial people, do you think, So perennial, if I can mix up premillennial and perennial here, why are they so popular? I mean, why does Lindsey sell? And he sold in the millions. I'm a little jealous.
Because of the events in the world. Cambodia.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you talking, so I interrupted you.
I'm sorry, I'm through.
Yeah, I think Cambodia, we don't even begin to know how bad things are there.
I feel so bad about interrupting you.
No, that's okay.
Our daughter, when she was in college, she was completely shook because of this Lindsey thing. She would constantly be bombarded by her friends who would talk about this prophecy. And that the prophecy in her particular case was the thing that it appeared to us the kids were so excited about, because they believed that was the prophecy. Yeah. Somehow they wanted to believe this prophecy, that they knew what was going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of people that way who they don't want to guess, do any more guessing.
Yeah.
They want to know somehow.
And they look for signs. And when, you know, the Jews returned to the homeland, that was a fulfillment of prophecy to many people. Mm-hmm. And evidence that therefore you can trust the prophecies, that kind of prophecies of the scriptures. And that there has to be, you see, that it's a kind of a literalistic sort of thing. There has to be literal fulfillment of some of these kinds of prophecies. And the trouble is, of course, that, you know, you can look through history. Norman Cohen has a book, on medieval millennialism, in which he, you know, The Pursuit of the Millennium, this fine book, in which he showed there were hundreds of different prophets coming along. The classic case in America is a group called the Millerites. William Miller in 1842, right outside Boston, predicted the end of the world. And many people sold their property and went up to the highest hill and, you know, talk about literalism, they put on sheets thinking that was going to get them ready for heaven. And, they, you know, I'm not critical, they just didn't know any better, because the only pictures they ever seen was, you know, bodies floating around with heaven with long, you know, with long trumpets and wings, and they always had look what it looked like sheets on. So if they're going to go be raptured, as they call raptured, or lifted into heavenly body, if you ever hear the term raptured, that simply means being lifted bodily. They were going to have to be ready for, you know, for this. And then, of course, nothing happened November 12th, 1842, and then, you know, back to the drawing board. Billy Graham doesn't predict any longer the precise date. When he first got started in his ministry, he was predicting the end of the world. But he says, you know, it's imminent. But I think that's a very important point that appeals to a lot of people. And therefore, to be ready for the millennium, the demands for what we call discipleship or strict living or accountability for our, you know, our moral life has to be raised. And you can make out a very good case, both for man-made, or I'll be talking about this on Thursday, I guess, man-made and natural disasters in this world which look this way, with the droughts, the plagues, pestilence, hunger, all these things. Cambodia is only, you know, one, Northern Ireland, the others that were mentioned this morning, for instance. And so on. And I think this has a fascination, and people have this kind of perennial, you know, interest in this. Some of you know Joe Shaw at our religion department, and when this Lindsay thing was at its height, he said he always checked with before he went on an airplane, he always checked with a pilot ahead of time. He was joking, but he said he always checked with a pilot ahead of time to see if he's premillennial, because if the end came, he wanted to be sure that he didn't have a premillennial pilot who would be raptured up to the skies and leave the plane pilotless. And yeah, Joe's a little sarcastic, but it, you know, that's how far it can go. Down to this, it's like, you know, Bishop Usher who predicted, or who announced, you know, the time of day and the year in which the world was created. Was it, you know, and down to 10:30 in the morning, and sort of they have a perennial kind of appeal. Well, the question this and the strictness thing, I think, is important. And then I was talking with somebody ahead of time. What also happens is out in the world, and is that employers like, for instance, the kind of hard work and discipline and self-control and all the rest that people like the Mormons have. Some of the hardest working graduate students I know, for instance, were Mormons, and they always did the little extra. They came early, they stayed late. They didn't, you know, they were, this was simply part of their faith. And very attractive, appealing kind of people, because they really felt this was what was expected from them. And no complaints, remarkable kind of thing to see. The question, you know, that I'd like to raise here for us then would be the implications for us. Should we, as mainliners, be more strict, you know, for membership and participation in our congregations? What do you think? I'll tell you what started it off in the other one, and where we did this 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, was that one minister said that if a couple who had not been to church and were not members of the church brought a baby to church for baptism, he would say no. He would say that the adults have to understand the Christian faith first before the baby can be baptized. Well, that didn't get the response from you that it did from that group 2 weeks ago, but maybe it's the weather. But that's wrong. Why? Well, it isn't a matter of when the coin into the box springs the core, you know, the soul from purgatory springs. It isn't, you know, the old Luther thing about Tetzel. It isn't quite. But, you know, I didn't mean to exaggerate what you were saying. There is a kind of an attractiveness there with the appeal of the church. What I'm wondering about is this the direction you think that the mainline churches should go? Yeah. If it gets people into church and it gets them into discipleship.
Maybe the answer would be yes to your question if we conceived of the mission of the church as being the amassing of additional numbers. I guess I have a little problem in the whole discussion today of thinking in terms of the church, now we talk about the organizational structure, as succeeding or failing or moving in the direction of success or direction of failure, and measuring that in terms of numbers or dollars. If that's the way to measure the mission of the church, then maybe we ought to be thinking about things like that. If we have a different goal or a mission that our Lord gave us, then maybe the answer to the question is no. And I think we have a different mission than to simply the accumulation of numbers, of people, of dollars.
But you see, it's not, how should I say this? I tend to agree, but I, stay with it here. It's not, what we call cheap grace that's being offered here.
No.
But do the conservative churches, do they promote, the self-discipleship, but do they make disciples?
Yeah. That's,
I guess the question, do I want what they have?
Yeah.
I don't think I do. I know I don't.
Okay.
Or I wouldn't be sitting where I am.
Yeah. You'd be out in the corner with a watchtower.
Yeah. going back to something I said when we were talking about Schuller, I think some of the stuff is unchristian. I don't want unchristian.
Yeah, these people wouldn't, be in the Schuller camp, but I see what you're saying, that it's a kind of protection against doubt, fear, but let's stay with yours, the measurement of success, but the Great Commission always says we should try to reach as many people as possible. And we can say, well, our church is small, and then we can sort of pat ourselves and say, we're not playing the numbers game.
But when the Watchtower people or the Mormons come to your house, they don't ever want to talk about Christ. All they want to talk about is their neat family, or the Watchtower people want to talk about the kingdom. And I try to get them back to Christ, which to me is what being a Christian is about. And that's not really important to them. I think that they relate to, like the Mormons relate to the families, which sounds really neat to a lot of people. They don't even know what Christ is all about. I don't think that's a conservative church. I don't even call that a Christian church.
Well,
I think they're cults more than they're churches.
Well, maybe you came in late. The author said he would rather call them strict churches, but the editor overruled him on it. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, strict, I didn't think they're strict as far as what a Christian is. A Christian church. I don't believe, when I've spoken with Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, they do not ever speak of Christ.
Okay.
And I think this is where they gather their people. They don't push Christ.
Okay, there's one further element there in these that we haven't talked about, in that they have sacred scripture besides the Bible. Each of these groups, the Book of Mormon, and the others, which is very attractive because if you heard Carl this morning, and I hope you understand what Carl's trying to do in his thing is not make doubters out of us. He's just trying to show that there are different ways of looking at different texts. And I think some eyebrows were raised when he gave his interpretation of the parable of the sowers today, which is not the the traditional one, and so on. But a lot of people, have some real questions because they say, Christian study, and you get all these learned theologians, and all they do is disagree. And if you don't believe me, go to a seminary sometime, and where I was, when Tillich would say, what did Niebuhr say today? Send a student in, and then the next day, he would attack Niebuhr for having said what he did, and then they'd go around. And if the really learned people can't agree, then how can lay people agree with this sort of thing? And usually, in times of stress and difficulty, in which, like we're living in today, when you can find additional, virtual sacred scripture as additional revelation, these are always very, very popular because they unlock the key, the mysteries to the scripture. It's very exciting to think that there is a new prophet on earth, that a new dispensation, if dispensationalism has come. And that with new powers, that God sees we're in trouble, and to bail us out, God has brought a new person to us with new information. And all of these groups that I've been talking about here have additional kinds of things. And it doesn't have to be just the strict ones in terms of morality, The best example of all, of course, would be the Christian Science Church with Mary Baker Eddy, Your Key to the Scriptures, in which she's got her unlocking, or the key, which makes, you know, all the difference. And I think that has some appeal, and in which the Bible, you know, especially some of the translations are really quite fuzzy. We tried this Friday in here at 4 o'clock, if some of you were here, and or Saturday, remember we went through the thing, and the King James was really very, very difficult. And our little group, that's right, we finally gave up virtually on it. And I think that's a tremendously strong appeal that these groups have, that there's a new prophet on earth, and we're always looking, what is it, you know, we're looking for a new, not necessarily a Messiah, but a new kind of leader. The Jews want a miracle and the Greeks want an argument. Isn't that it? Yeah. As evidence that they aren't satisfied with what they have, but the Greeks with their intellect won an argument, and the Jews won another kind of miracle, that they weren't satisfied with the one they got at Bethlehem. And I think that really helps explain why many of these are as popular as they are. And I, my own personal feeling is that I think they'll continue in this way, because world conditions aren't getting any better. If you haven't heard lately,
they never have been.
They never have been.
That's saving grace in the whole.
Yeah, but there hasn't been 10% inflation every year. That's the one that bugs me. But you know, there's never been a good old age. That's true.
Never has been.
Yeah, but you know, the future is. Well, I don't want to get started on that, off the track on that. But they thrive on the fact that there was once a golden age. And the Mormons have this back in the early days of Utah, and so on, and the excitement that comes with this. Let me ask you one. Yeah,
I don't want to get you off the track, sure. But I'm interested. I didn't quite finish what he says here. But does he do anything with churches that are outside of the scope of American culture? Because I wonder if there would be.
Oh, the cults.
Well, no. What I'm thinking in terms of Christian phenomenon in other areas of the world that are not locked into success, that are not locked into Protestant ethic.
Yeah. Well, it's true the Pentecostal churches have
sort of a different.
Yeah.
That comes with a different.
Yeah, the Pentecostal churches had a tremendous boom in the early 70s in South America, just a phenomenal growth.
Right.
And I just have lost track on what's happened to that. One, Carlos Ortiz, that was the big name. And they got into that discipleship battle, and I don't know what happened that time. And that would be a good case where a very an explicitly cultic kind of emphasis, the Pentecostal, did grow in an atmosphere which had been Catholic or indifferent beforehand. But that, I don't
Pentecostal
know.
Of course brings in another element.
Yeah. And I'll talk about that when Thursday and Friday. Okay, so you see, we cover everything in here.
Yeah.
The students always say, you take one course from George, you take them all, because he talks about everything in every class, so we don't have a tight agenda.
It certainly is true that the nature of many people is to grasp for something that they don't have to think about, that is all outlined, and where the answers are all provided, that even where there are no questions. Significant, for instance, you mentioned the Millerites before, you mentioned back to the drawing board. He did go back to the drawing board, and he said, "Oops, I made a mistake." It's next year.
It's next year.
They came
back again. Yeah.
Capacity to do this. But you mentioned not only that the quote conservative unquote churches are growing, but also that the mainline churches have lost a significant number. Is it just possible that maybe part of what we're dealing with here is part of the explanation for it can be traced to the fact that some changes have been happening in the mainline churches that caused the people to leave the mainline churches and join the more quote conservative unquote churches.
That's a mistake.
That must be. We got 12 minutes.
Yeah, I think some of that is Pentecostal. Like Larry Christensen told me, even though his church went neo-Pentecostal, that some of them didn't think he went far enough. So they joined Assemblies of God or Foursquare. So some of that's due to the Pentecostal thing, and I think some of that is due to this, to the idea that the mainline churches, you know, were too involved, especially in social outreach. Remember how much money the Presbyterian Church lost when they gave $10,000 for the defense of Angela Davis? Well, she had a lot of things going against her. She was a black woman and a communist, you know, and then she went on trial, and the Pentecostal said she should have a fair trial. I'm not Pentecostal, the Presbyterians said she should have a fair trial. And so they gave $10,000, and they lost millions. Yeah. And as one interest, I think, of decline with this, one thing we didn't take up here because it is some of the cults like the Moonies and all the others. But what's interesting, I'd be glad to talk about them, but it's interesting that the strict churches here are appealing to young people as well as to middle-aged and older ones. And, you know, why is that? I suppose, I thought youth was supposed to be the age of rebellion and, you know, the ritualistic slaying of the father and all those things. Yet, within these groups, it's the young people who are doing the thing. Some of us were talking, about Mormon missionaries. I think we've all seen the very earnest young men in the white shirts and ties peddling around town with their bikes, well obviously with their bikes, but with their Bibles and talking to everybody. We saw them in Chiang Mai, Thailand, 14,000 miles away, and they had spent a year in language education before they went there. Some had studied Japanese for 2 years and then went for their 2 years of this. But, you know, why, you know?
Maybe that is a rebellion too, in a sense, you know, going to Mormonism from the structure of their parents' church. That could be part of the rebellion too, in a sense.
But it, you know, they're becoming, they never have the fling, so to speak, of a rebellion against that which they, you know, in which they were reared. And they seem, and certainly Hare Krishna and the Moonies, the children of God, the Cogs as we call them, draw exclusively from young people, as do these people.
It seems like that there could be a rebellion.
Well, it could be a rebellion. Yeah, that I see what you're saying. Yeah, we had a classic case in Northfield. I don't want to necessarily deal in personalities, but a very liberal, in terms of theology, member of the religion department at Carleton had his son join Divine Light Mission, which is about as irrational as you can get. And it was what young, it is free, I won't use his last name, decided, what's the religion that I can join that's the farthest away from my father's? And he came up with Divine Light Mission, which is this Maharaja, this 17-year-old cherub from India, who was convicted for smuggling in wristwatches, wasn't it? You know, it takes all kinds to be prophets, but to make profits. But I think there is something to that a lot of young people need structure and order, which they didn't get, and they need a cause.
The question you asked still runs in my mind, that, you know, would we want to be more strict in our church? And I've been trying to think of, if I was to talk to the council and say I would want to be more strict, I'm trying to think of what reason I could give them that people would follow. I can't think of a one. You know, a good
I'm
reason.
Still bothered about that baptism.
Well, he would argue that the parents are responsible for the child, and the parents saw baptism only as something which is expected of parents, because isn't it nice and you can have a family dinner and a christening and a silver cup and all these things, and that unless the parents are serious about church membership, he wasn't ready to be the channel through which one of the sacraments was dispensed. That's what his name was, Don Solberg. That's what he would say in answer, that it's the parents' responsibility, and therefore they have to show some concern for baptism before they went through with what otherwise would be pure, you know, just empty or social ritual. And of course, on the other hand, there is provision within the Catholic and the Lutheran and the other mainline churches for emergency, you know, layperson baptism. It isn't that it has to be done in the church, and in that sense, there is a kind of a flexibility in baptism. I mean, if a baby's dying in the hospital, a nurse can, you know, can baptize, if that helps. But I see what you're saying. You're not a Baptist.
I'm a Lutheran.
Okay.
I just can't. conceive of a pastor refusing to baptize a child.
Well, it caused, as I say, and there were some who agreed. Maybe on that note, since it'll be about 2 minutes or 3 minutes before the 5 o'clock bell, we can split. And if you want to come back tomorrow with some things, I've got a good article by Martin Marty on baptism, which we can talk about that. But also tomorrow we want to talk about some of the other changes. And if you're interested in any of the book, by all means, there's a surplus in the bookstore, and they don't want to send them back to the publisher. That'll cost Holden money. So. If you want one, fine. If you don't, why don't you? If you're interested, we'll be back tomorrow, and we'll take up some other of the religious themes and developments that are taking place in America at this time. And then Wednesday, I've asked Emily to talk about inner healing, and so we'll do that. Okay, and with a little bit of emphasis on Ruth Carter Stapleton. And my point is not because she's news right now. I think she would have been well known with or without her brother's help. Look what happened. Billy got to be known too, and look what happened to him. So, okay. Well, I guess nobody here is buying for the strict option. Well, we'll try it again and see if you know.
What happened to Billy besides getting famous and rich? I don't know.
Well, he's gotten to be a standing joke.
Yeah.
And really, he doesn't. I think he's finally catching on that he's being used on the talk shows and the other places. That's better. Yeah.
Opened his mouth and told everyone
he was a fool. Yeah. Right. He couldn't handle fame or notoriety anyway. Yeah. It's too bad.
What do you mean by inner healing?
Come and find out.
Can't wait.
That's a hooker.
No,
that's
got
to be.
Sorry?
I said, I'm not going to be here.
Oh. Well, if you know Agnes Sanford, she writes very clearly and very, I think, well in this field too. Agnes Sanford, yeah. And in a responsible, I mean, you know, we get into the healing game and you can get a lot of charlatans, you really can, but
it's like a circus act.
But the Agnes Sanford Wright, yeah, is really very, very responsible. And there are some others, a Catholic, Francis McNutt, he's in the Pentecostal thing. There are some, there really are. And inner healing doesn't mean the old Roberts, Oral Roberts, you know, the instant cure of cancer or anything else like that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.